Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
It's wonderful that Dr. Christina Jeffrey could come back and be with us on Church and Culture today. There's so many things going on in the area of challenges to the Constitution of the United States ever since the 2016 election. It's really, in my view, crazy things, totally out of touch with not just the Constitution Declaration, but the entire world of thought that went into creating those. Dr. Jeffrey or Christina is going to be able to clarify things. Christina, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I just want to remind people, you were on some months ago talking about your unfortunate experience after being appointed as the official historian to the U.S. Congress. But prior to that, you were professor at Kennesaw State University, and obviously that's where you met and got to know Newt Gingrich. And you are a graduate of Vassar College.
No, I'm not. I'm a refugee from Vassar.
A refugee. You went from there to the University of Plano and then got your Ph.D. in political science from University of Alabama. And I know you cried the other night, didn't you?
Well, I thought about it. I thought about crying, and then I realized Clemson has just hired my daughter to teach.
Okay. That's the way to resolve that. To do what, by the way?
Teach political science and the Institute for the Study of Capitalism.
The torch.
Which doesn't study capitalism. It studies all the necessary things you must have if you're going to have a capitalist economy.
Like excellent. Well, Clemson's a great place, and I know she'll love
great
it.
Place.
And plus, it's in
and
the South.
Cambo and I both worked for Bear Bryant. He coached for Bear Bryant. He played for Bear Bryant, and I tutored quarterbacks.
Amazing.
Alabama kept me waiting around for 12 years to get my Ph.D., so this is an easy transition.
Did you tutor Joe Namath?
No, I'm not that old.
Okay, that's the only one I remember. But anyway.
Pretty old, but I'm not that old.
We are going off on a tangent.
Yes, we are, but it's okay.
Here is what I think a lot of people are wondering. You know, Trump was not the first president to lose the popular vote, and certainly not the only Republican. There have been Democrats who lost the popular vote, very popular Democrats. Yet, in this particular case, you had more than a few people, you had a lot of media people, even intellectuals, so to speak, say we need to get rid of the Electoral College. And in the midst of that, it wasn't really a debate, it was just a series of expletives. I didn't hear anybody actually provide the rationale of why there was Electoral College in the first place, as if it didn't matter.
No, that was just dead white males screwing up the world for all the wonderful people who were going to come after them.
Well, what is, I mean, let our listeners know if they don't already, what is the basic rationale for there being an Electoral College?
Well, the basic rationale is we don't want a popular election because masses, democracies, can be moved by emotions. So giving the territories, in this case the states, a weight in the electoral process makes the process less democratic, small d democratic. Not because there's something wrong with people, but because people can be moved by emotions. And the states have an interest in who is elected. They have an interest in the nation, and that interest is not just based on popularity. It's based on the differences in the states. And George Washington, in his farewell address, talks about the West and the South and the East and the North and the different contributions that these parts of the country make. They're important. Just to have one big, massive Soviet Union type of country is very inconsistent with what the founders intended.
Well, let's drill down on a few of the elements that you made so clear right there. Let me try to list them before we go through them. One is the value of there being separate states, right? Their integrity, so to speak. Two, the importance of understanding locality and regionality, to sound fancy, and its relationship to the well-being of the country as a whole. And finally, the issue of political passion and prudence, or lack of it. But let's start with states. I mean, it's clear to me that in my lifetime, the only state I've ever lived in where people really got up and yelled and screamed about being from that state was Texas. And that's where I spent most of my time growing up. I mean, in Texas, you really get the sense that, not that you're a Texan first and American second, but that Texan is just as important.
And if you were born there and moved after 11 months, you're still a Texan.
You're still a Texan because it gets hold of you. So, I mean, how many states, or better way to put it, isn't it the case that the average person out there doesn't really take states into account when they think of a national election? They think of the country as a whole.
I don't know. It must depend on the state. That is not true in South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't true in Georgia when I lived in Georgia. It wasn't true in Alabama. When
okay, so I'm wrong.
Alabama.
So I'm wrong. I'm wrong.
That sounds like a northern thing.
Well, maybe I've lived up here too long. But again, though, there was no immediate voice or voices saying, well, we've got to remember the importance of states. And it used to be, of course, state rights. Is this a state's rights issue?
Well, your state's rights advocates, for historical reasons, if no other reasons, but I think there are other reasons, have traditionally, beginning at the very beginning of the nation, in the South, most conscious of
okay.
the importance of states.
And probably still are, you think?
I think so. Mm-hmm. And it's less true because you've had enormous population shifts. The South has been very attractive to immigrants. It has been very attractive to businesses wanting cheaper labor. It's been very attractive to people who want to get away from high taxes. So they come to South Carolina and they vote for high taxes. Because they seem so low to them.
So to move from states into regionalism, you quote George Washington talking about the way in which the various regions have their own unique kind of contribution to make to the whole. So there's an attempt to keep the power spread out. Is that a good way to put it?
Well, I think so, but also to tamp down on the regionalism, because Washington's message is that we need all the parts of this nation. They're all essential to this great nation that we have. But you're one, you know, I'm sort of.
And by the way, let's throw in here that he made his living prior to being a military man as a surveyor.
Yes. So he's very aware of geography. That helped him a lot in the military, too. But to your point that people take states less seriously as professors, how many state-oriented classes do you see on the schedule in the history and the political science?
Zero.
Zero to few.
Yes.
And when I taught state and local government, invariably you're handed a book on state and local government that's supposed to be teaching state and local government to university students who come from all kinds of different states. It's extremely hard. You're much better off, and eventually I ended up doing this, teaching the state where you are and pointing out how it's different in other places. But if you don't master one state, you are probably not going to master any state. You're just not going to understand state government at all. But the fact that universities don't take state history and state government seriously, I think is indicative that our elites are really into this one nation part and not so into a nation of states.
And by the way, should let our listeners know that Democrats have already introduced a bill to do away with the Electoral College. Would you explain to our listeners, what does it take to actually remove the Electoral College from the Constitution?
Well, they've proposed an amendment
to the Constitution.
It's going to go to a committee, probably a Judiciary Committee. It's going to have to pass in the committee and then get scheduled for a vote, and it will have to win a majority of the House and then go to the Senate, where it will die.
And why will it die?
It will die because there are more Republicans in the Senate. But, you know,
is only a majority vote required in the Senate for a bill to amend the Constitution?
I think it's two-thirds. Yeah.
I do, too, yeah. It's
right.
Definitely going
to. Then it goes to the states, and it's three-fourths. So even though we probably have some Republicans that would be stupid enough to vote for that bill, they won't get the necessary two-thirds.
And so then, but let's say it did get two-thirds. Oh, by the way, it's two-thirds in both the House and the Senate.
Right,
and then, so it's going to die in the House, right?
It's probably going to die in the House.
Yeah. But then if it got two-thirds, and does that have to be signed to the president, or does it go directly to the state legislature?
It goes directly to the states. And remember, it's kind of a messy process. Remember, the most recent amendment was actually the 13th amendment that Madison proposed. And the Congress approved and sent to the states. They sent 13 to the states, and we adopted 10. But one of them got lost in Texas.
Which one?
The one that said...
The one outlawing drinking?
No. The most recent amendment was proposed back in 1788. I think 1789, but anyway, that first batch of amendments, the Bill of Rights, was the bill that said Congress can't raise its salary in the same, no congressman can vote for an increase in salary if they've just been elected.
Would they have to be in a second term or something
right.
like that? So, we don't really miss that one very much, do we?
Well, it's now been adopted.
Oh.
It's now part of our Constitution.
Okay. Well, I guess the Texans found it.
Well, a graduate student at the university found it.
Really?
Yeah, you know how boring it is to do research on your dissertation? Well, you know, you wander off and do other things.
Every now and then. It's like finding a Mozart string quartet nobody knew about. So this is all just for media consumption, this bill. These kinds of bills to change the Constitution, they simply become talking points, correct?
Well, it allows them to have guests on to talk about how important and useful and what obstructionists the Republicans are. And you know, they play a long game. So they start this, and they won't get off of it. They'll keep it up and keep it up and keep it up. And eventually they hope to succeed. But they don't get upset if they're turned down. They just keep it up. They've also introduced a bill to change the First Amendment, because free speech is interfering with their idea of what should be allowed in elections.
Well, tell us about that bill. How do they want to change the First Amendment's Constitution?
Well, I haven't gotten, all I've gotten is the media stories. I haven't read the bill yet. But remember, I think it was it Biden and Schumer who were proposing this 10, 12 years ago, changing the First Amendment? It was right after, when was Citizens United? That's not that long ago, maybe 8 years ago.
Oh, that's right. I remember this being generated out of that.
Uh-huh. We have to change the Constitution.
That decision was in... kaboom here.
It was Clinton.
2010.
Oh, was it during the... Well, it started before.
Yeah, it was...
The Clinton decided in 2010.
Yeah, and so do you recall the short version of what that Supreme Court decision was about?
Well, it had to do with a movie that was critical of Hillary Clinton. And the Democrats sued the Republicans who created it and distributed it. They wanted to stop the distribution.
The problem was that the part of Citizens United that did it was a nonprofit, and having run a nonprofit for many, many years, I understand, they argued that if for nonprofit, for donors to be able to take, you know, their contributions and report them on their income tax for deductions, you're not supposed to be serving a partisan cause. And this film of Hillary Clinton was accused, and I think perhaps rightfully between you and me, of being a partisan cause. But it's very well known among nonprofit groups in Washington that you can get away with this stuff. I mean, all kind of nonprofit groups are very, very partisan.
Deal, I actually taught nonprofit management.
Oh, then tell us about it.
And there is a certain percent,
7.
I think it's gone up to 15%,
to that
7%. A nonprofit can spend on political advocacy.
Right, yeah. Well, if they were under 15% or whatever it was, then they were abiding by the law.
Absolutely.
But then how did Biden and company want to change the First Amendment to keep nonprofits from doing this?
Well, they wanted an exception for political speech. Political speech should be regulated because, after all, that's in the government's wheelhouse, right? The government ought to be able to regulate political speech. Makes perfect sense if you're a Democrat. But if you're the founding fathers, the reason for the First Amendment was to protect religion and politics.
Well, isn't the politics a thing that you exactly don't want regulated by the government? I mean, isn't that exactly the thing you want to protect?
That's exactly it, right? I mean, you know, in the Soviet Union, which regulated everything, the dissidents got away with writing poetry. Yeah, they were harassed, and there was Soviet art and all that. But the people who got sent to the gulag were the people who talked about politics, because that's a direct threat to the regime. Oh, they want to get rid of they're not talking about it, but the most dangerous thing in our Constitution to political people, to totalitarian impulses in the political realm, is the right to assemble. And they are attacking our right to assemble every time.
Okay.
Charles Murray shows up at a college and can't
speak. Now, what part of the Constitution is covered by right of assembly?
The First Amendment.
Oh, it's all under
the right to assemble.
Okay. And I need to read the First Amendment real quick while we're talking. Keep going.
It's got all kinds of good stuff in it.
I should have.
And they, of course, have a bill now to disarm us, because they promised that.
Yeah.
So that's the Second Amendment.
Well, let me go through these fundamentals of the First Amendment. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, right to assemble, and right to petition. So here you have speech, and they want to, and press. What if somebody introduced a measure to restrict the freedom of the press? What do you think would happen?
They would go crazy.
Like throwing Jim Acosta out of the White House.
But they, yeah, right. He thinks that if he doesn't have gold engraved invitation, that he's being discriminated against, as though every reporter in the country wouldn't like to be at the White House.
Now, to let you continue to discuss it, how are they trying to restrict the right to assemble?
They're doing that by mobs.
Oh.
They're using mobs for that.
Yes.
And in a lot of places, the mayors, the university presidents say, for the sake of safety, we have to call off this talk.
Which is nonsense.
Of course it's nonsense. But there's been a lot of weak-kneed responses. And, what we talked about last time, Newt Gingrich caving to Schumer and Barney Frank and Patsy Schroeder and Maxine Waters, the usual suspects, Nadler. These are people who called on him to fire me, and he did it.
Yes. It's such a sad story. Let's not tell it again.
We don't need to talk about it anymore, but it's a sad story.
Yeah. And
all the things that I told him would happen, happened. He probably would have become president if he'd been a little stronger.
Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm. Remember the picture of, was it Best Review or the Weekly Standard, where at the end of that term in December, he's negotiating with Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton is eating his lunch, and the picture is a picture of Newt just melting.
Yeah. I always wondered why that happened. I still don't know why it happened. But he did. I mean, he did back down on so many things that he... wasn't it something like the Something for America?
Go Pack?
No. Newt Gingrich had come up with the...
The compact with America.
Yes.
And they called it the Contract on America.
Yeah, and he didn't follow through.
Well, he had a fundamental misunderstanding of
contract with America.
Yeah, contract with America. Contract for America. I don't know.
Contract with America. I'm looking at it.
Oh. His fundamental misunderstanding was, and he told me this, and when he said it, I didn't know what to say. He said, "I'm going to be a nonpartisan speaker. So I have to be as attentive to the Democrats as I am to the Republicans."
I bet he'd take that back.
I think he regrets that.
At this point, I know him a little bit. I know his wife a little bit, and the ambassador to the Vatican. I'm absolutely 100% positive he would take that back at this point.
This is hard.
So these attacks on the fundamentals of the Constitution, are they getting away with it because nobody knows the Constitution or nobody knows the signal importance, the first principles of what America is grounded upon?
Well, they're not teaching that, except in a few places. I happen to be in a school district that does teach it. I called them on Constitution Day and asked what they were doing, and by golly, they had a good program in every single school.
Really?
And
this is Spartanburg, South Carolina?
Spartanburg, South Carolina, District 7. I'm the DAR Constitution chair, so I don't know if I've had anything to do with that, but the first time I checked on a school, they were doing some kind of UN project. That was their Constitution Day event. But the one federal mandate that I support wholeheartedly is unfunded mandate, is the mandate that every federally assisted school or office in the whole United States is required to have some program, celebration, education, speaker, something to honor the Constitution.
Well, to educate.
Honor near September 17th.
Now, I myself had to be reminded of what was in the First Amendment. I feel shame. So therefore, to get over my shame, we're going to take a short break. And we will be back with Dr. Christina Jeffrey in just a moment.
Courage, dear heart. Come see Aslan on stage. Christ the King Homeschool presents The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at Whitmore Lake High School, 7430 Whitmore Lake Road, on April 11th and 12th at 7:30 p.m. and the 13th at 2 p.m. Suggested donations are $10 for adults, $5 for children, or $30 for an entire family. That's A Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at Whitmore Lake High School, April 11th through April 13th.
Hi, I'm Dan Weingartz. Join us for our season opener sale going on now through April 13th. Our family has been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment for your lawn since 1945. Our experts will help you choose the right product from top brands like Steel. From legendary chainsaws, dependable trimmers, and powerful blowers, a Steel is designed for reliability and built for the long haul. Visit us to see the full Steel line or see all of our season opener specials at Weingartz.com.
Weingartz, everything.
Al Cresta was the keynote speaker for the Ann Arbor 40 Days for Life campaign kickoff.
Cultures will be judged in many ways, but eventually every culture will be judged by this question: how did it treat its people? Now, Christians should understand this better than anyone, because in a way this is analogous to the Last Judgment. In Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus sorts the sheep and the goats, what's the question he asks? How have you treated the least among you?
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Lent brings us not only the 40 Days for Life campaign, but it also brings more pregnancy center banquets. On our next program, we'll hear Janet Morana from the Family Life Services Banquet and Al Cruster from the 40 Days for Life kickoff. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
I'm back with Dr. Christina Jeffrey, talking to us from Spartanburg, South Carolina. And, you know, Christina, one thing that I've been hearing about, but I don't really understand what it's all about, is this convention of states. Who has proposed this and why?
There's a group called Convention of States Project, COSP. Mark Meckler and Michael Ferris Mark Meckler.
Well, I know Mike Ferris. So is he part of this?
Well, he was. So I think maybe he's figured it out. I don't think he's a part of it anymore. But they raised an enormous amount of money and had a mock constitutional convention, which Meckler admitted that this was, you know, he argued and he stressed that this was just practice. It's for educational purposes. The real convention wouldn't be like that. But at the convention itself, he told the people there, you can do this. This, you are prepared. You are ready for a constitution of the states. Now, I also went to a panel on this topic in 2016 or 15 at the American Political Science Association. Lots of big, smart, constitutional lawyers, professors think that this will work. But if you've studied or been exposed to formal parliamentary language in constitution writing language, and you read in Article 5 that the Congress can call for a convention to adopt amendments. It's not the states calling the convention. The states can ask Congress when I think it's two-thirds of the states ask Congress to call this convention, they can call the convention. But the states are going to have no control over it. They're going to have, you know, their whole part is just to ask.
Ask the Congress under Article 5.
Right, and Congress decides which amendments it's going to call for.
Well, how does that solve the problem? If this is a conservative effort, which it seems to be at least in its origin, how does giving a standing Congress, even such as the one we have now, the power to put together a constitutional convention, how does that help the problem?
Well, let me read you something from a John Birch Society publication on this. It's called Who's Behind the Constitutional Convention? And this is really priceless. Congress calls the convention. Of course, that means Congress, a branch of the same federal government that advocates of a convention claim the convention would rein in, has the power, according to Article 1, Section 8, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the convention.
Well, I mean, if someone had come up to me on the street and explained this, just the way you explained it to me right now, I would have said, why? Why would you waste your time and energy empowering a Congress, which, by the way, it all comes about. You don't know who's going to be in power and how the two houses are going to be constituted. Why would you hand them that power?
No, it's exactly the opposite. Here's the second pull-out quote from this. It's a fairly, like a five-page article. The second and perhaps equally obvious problem is that the same legislators who the advocates of a constitutional convention claim are going to save us by way of a convention are themselves complicit in the overreach of the federal government. We know that we're in debt.
In other words, it's even more fundamental. It's even more fundamental than the U.S. Congress. It's in the state legislatures, too.
Yeah. So, and if people don't obey the Constitution that we have, and Aristotle says people are much more inclined to obey old laws over new laws, why would they obey the new?
And I'm seeing here that the Koch brothers were behind part of the funding of this.
Yes, that really says it all.
I just don't get it. I mean, I've been around town in politics long enough to see millions of dollars thrown away for, you know, these sort of, they're supposed to be history-changing efforts and projects. When you and I, in 10 minutes, uncover the various fatal flaws of this one. But yet it's still out there.
Yes. Yes, and but what I have, you know, when we decided we're going to do this, I did a little bit more research than I've done, and I've been mystified by the intensity in which some people push this. Well, a lot of
I'll tell you how. I mean, I can explain that, Christina.
They're paid.
Koch brothers' money.
Yeah.
I have a friend, an old friend, who told when I first took over my nonprofit Crisis Magazine, and I had some experiences with donors who wanted certain things done that I didn't want to do. He explained to me that he had had a nonprofit once, and the only money that he could raise from a guy who was interested in bomb shelters. And so he ended up doing his nonprofit, doing all their work on bomb shelters, meaning that that's the power of the money, and there's just some money you can't take if you want to do your mission.
Yes. Lack of money is not the root of all evil.
Yeah, it's just,
some evil is caused by money. A lot of evil is caused by money.
I had only one case in my 15 years of Crisis Magazine where I took some money I regretted, not because what the donor wanted to do is bad, was good, but it was too tangential. Took me away from my core mission.
Mm-hmm.
So that is going on. In this political environment, the idea of a convention to amend the Constitution would be, to me, a kind of almost demonic reality.
Yeah, it would be. I think we can get over all of the problems that we have in this country. And I think the reason I think we can is we have such a solid, best in the world, best in history constitution. But if we let a Congress that would, any Congress that would call for this would be a Congress that then could completely change the Constitution in ways that would suit them.
Well, let's talk about some of the folks that have come on the scene lately.
Speaking of that sort.
Yeah, we have Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, who demonstrated both during the campaign and even post-election that she had very little familiarity with the Constitution and the separation of powers. How do you explain a phenomenon like that?
Well, some people think that she's pretending to be stupid because they can't get their head around somebody coming out of a top college with good grades and knowing so little. But
those people are out of touch with colleges.
They're out of touch with colleges, that's right. That's not hard for me to imagine. But her inability to do math is startling because at least she has to take the money she makes at the bar and pay her rent and things like that. Her green project would cost $18 trillion. And Congress doesn't want to spend $5 billion on national security.
Well, she went to Boston University. Again, is it just because she's kind of cute and her age and her ethnicity, she kind of fits the media-driven environment of American politics? Is that it?
That's right. They can get her on any show. Because she's, and I don't want to say this in a, you know, physically she's attractive. She's a hot property for these shows. They don't know what she's going to say. Might make the front page of the New York Times.
Oh, I see her quoted every day.
Mm-hmm.
Which annoys me because I don't care to see that. Now, you mentioned Rashida Tlaib, who is U.S. Representative from Michigan's 13th District, western half of Detroit. Isn't she the one who called President Trump an MF? Isn't she the one?
In front of her 8-year-old son, I thought Muslim women were supposed to be very demure and modest and proper.
She appears to me to be more of a secular Muslim. I don't know. I mean, in other words, she's certainly not well-mannered. But is she? And of course, she's very publicly and rather aggressively anti-Israel.
Right, and of course, how many Muslims ran for Congress this year? I think it was 50.
Well, I don't have a problem with. I mean, that's fine.
Well,
I mean, there are a lot of good conservative Muslims out there.
Wait.
What?
I'm concerned about the Constitution. And when I heard...
Oh, you're talking about Sharia law?
Yeah, when I heard... what's the name of that organization? There's a Muslim educational organization called CARE. And they also do philanthropic work and who knows what else. And this was an interview on National Public Radio, and the interviewer said, so do you support the Constitution? He says, oh, yes, I live here. I support the Constitution. Well, if Muslims were in the majority, would you still support the Constitution? He said, no, we would have Sharia law.
Well, that's very unlikely. It may happen in France long before it ever happened in the United States. But I was has Tlaib made any comments in terms of the inclusion of Sharia law?
Well, she comes from Detroit, and they have.
I got to see a quote. I can't just infer.
No, I she was not on my radar screen she put herself out there.
I would just say categorically that any Muslim or anyone who thought that Sharia law should become conjoined with U.S. law at any level, from the bottom to the top, should be voted down, should be rejected.
But I have not encountered a Muslim who rejected Sharia law.
Oh, I have many.
Oh, good. That's good to know.
Of course, I'm in Washington, so, you know, everybody's up here.
Well, that's good. That's
yeah.
That's,
and there's a very strong Muslim intellectual community, even in, especially around Detroit. And I've met with them. And I've also met with the Arab Christians, the Chaldean Christians, who are amazing.
They are amazing.
To meet with. Well, how does a newly elected member of Congress get away with that kind of profane diatribe and actually, you know, be defended or at least ignored? You know, Nancy Pelosi said that she doesn't censor speech.
They only want to censor our speech. It's like that town in Colorado that passed laws to, you know, to turn in guns.
Well, they certainly can't criticize the president anymore for his use of the F word, which I understand is fairly common inside the White House and other places. And, you know, it's just like golf. Can I explain to you the golf thing?
Oh, yes, please.
Because I was part of the Bush crowd. Bush, after 9/11, stopped playing golf. He said he wasn't going to play any more golf while he was president. the little bit of golf he played before 9/11, he got criticized every time he went out. You know, country club Republican. Barack Obama played more golf than all the presidents of the United States combined. And I never saw a single story that took him to task for that, except from the conservative side. But even then, they didn't want to do it because they didn't want it turned around on him when a Republican became president. And so you have a double standards in everything, all kinds of behavior, language. You look at how Kamala Harris is being treated when she had a sexual abuse case on her own staff that she basically ignored.
Mm-hmm.
She's not paying any price for that.
The terrible double standard.
And the double standard, the press, now tell me if you agree with this. The function of the press is transparency and fairness. With a healthy press, the press would say, you're applying one standard to Republicans and one to Democrats. You shouldn't do that. And they would press on it until these players stopped doing it, because the media would create a frame in which those kind of comments seem silly. But we don't have a press like that, do we?
No, we don't. They're trained in indoctrination centers.
I want to share this. For some years, I had a regular monthly lunch with Robert Novak in Washington.
Oh, yeah? That must have been fun.
Yeah, and I was the one that took he and his wife to Israel for the first time and the second time. That's quite a story. But
will you take Robin? Will you take Robin and me?
Sure. Next time I go, let's go.
Okay.
And so I've been there quite a bit, not in 3 or 4 years. So he told me the first time we had lunch, he said, he told the story of E.J. Dionne, who was a Catholic columnist in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And he told me that he was very close friends with E.J., but he watched how year after year, E.J. became a partisan. He stopped being a reporter, a journalist, but became completely a partisan. And he shook, Novak, of course, was the old soul of the Washington Press Corps. And he just shook his head and he said, they're all gone. All the real reporters and journalists are gone.
Yeah, there's one other thing that I'd like to talk about, and that's something that really got me energized on the Constitution, even though I'm not currently teaching constitutional law, and that is the focused effort to get rid of the requirement to be a natural-born citizen.
Now, what form is that effort taking? Is there a bill in Congress?
Well, no. It's really pretty quiet, except for it suddenly burst out, and people paying any attention suddenly realized that. After a 200 and almost 250 year country, no major party ever nominated somebody who wasn't what everybody knew to be a natural born citizen. Suddenly, in the 80s, and then again picking up in the 2000s. People began to either attack people who wanted more fundamental changes, to attack that clause as unfair, or along with that, doing that, introduced, there were 10 amendments introduced in Congress to change the eligibility requirements for president.
But this would require an amendment to the Constitution, correct?
Right. Exactly.
So that's not going to happen either.
Well,
unless there's a way to do it without changing the Constitution.
Right. So there. So a lawyer in 2010. I actually wrote a paper on this. I'll send it to you. Her name was Sarah Hairholy, and she was some university up there, Case Western or something like that. And this was a review article, and she just came right out and said, okay, you know, there have been these 10 amendments proposed. It's not going to work. Yeah, none of those amendments got more. I mean, most of them had 1, 2, or no more than 6 sponsors.
By the way, let me just tell our listeners, Sarah P. Hairlihy wrote in December of 2005, amending the natural born citizen requirement, globalization as the impetus and obstacle.
Right. Well, she was giving up on amending because she said it just isn't going to happen. So we have to change people's understanding of what constitutes a natural born citizen.
Ah, we changed the definition. How convenient.
Oh, right. I mean, she's just right out there advocating Orwellian changes.
So how does she want to define it?
She wants
to define it. If you feel in your heart you were born here, you were?
Well, I think she and probably there's a new effort. There's a new article on this. A new proposal from a law professor at the University of Richmond, and he has an amendment to change the Constitution so that you can be considered a natural born citizen. Well, in fact, you take that term out because we all know that a natural born citizen has 2 citizen parents and was born in U.S. jurisdiction. We know that. But just a citizen is enough. He calls it the One America solution.
Well, you know, actually, it's a smart strategy if you're on that side to go after the definition of something that's in the Constitution and redefine that rather than going in and trying to change the Constitution itself, which isn't going to happen. And I take it that this definition of a natural born citizen could be adjudicated in the court system. Is that right?
Well, we're hoping that it will be. We're working on a bill in South Carolina to have the parties are no longer reliable for vetting presidential candidates on constitutional eligibility because a controversy has been stirred up and now people are defining it however they want to. So that if the party has somebody like Marco Rubio who's so attractive and would make such a great president, we're going to say, well, you know, he was born here, his parents are citizens now, he's essentially a natural-born citizen, but he's not. And it's changing the Constitution by ignoring the Constitution. And it's those kinds of little cuts that are changing our Constitution. I don't think we're going to get a con-con, but we're going to work against it in our state legislature to make sure we don't get a con-con. But this is under the radar screen. Suddenly, in 2012, we had Bobby Jindal. People were talking about Nikki Haley. Ted Cruz was running. Marco Rubio was running. And people, and if you said, well, so-and-so's not a natural born citizen, I mean, you'd just be thrown out of the cocktail party.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. I was not aware of this. And maybe our listeners were not, but this is something we need to keep a close eye on, like you say, these Orwellian tactics. I've been talking with Dr. Christina Jeffrey, who's been on Church and Culture before, and will be on Church and Culture again, I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. And to all you're listening, I'll be back on this day, this time, next week. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.